to thank everyone for coming out tonight. Welcome you to the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. My name is Laura Ciello. I'm the Director of Programs here. Just to let you know a little bit about HSP, we were formed in 1824, and we have over 21 million documents in our collection here. Everything from the founding documents of our nation to the stories of our most recent immigrant communities. I wanted to thank our co-sponsors, Bartram's Garden and the Library Company of Philadelphia. Some of the items you see on the back table are from the Library Company as well as from HSP's collection. And I'd also want to recommend that you pick up a copy of this great book. It is downstairs for sale. They're $40 each. So I'm sure the co-editors would be happy to sign them for you once we're done tonight. And I wanted to introduce Nancy Hoffman. She is the co-editor with Thomas Halleck of this book, William Bartram, The Search for Nature's Design, published by the University of Georgia Press this year. She is currently an adjunct professor of English at Villanova University, where she teaches courses in early American literature. She holds a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania in American Civilization. So, welcome, Nancy.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to welcome all of you this afternoon, early evening. The HSP staff has been extremely helpful in pulling together this event, and I hope that by the end you'll be very curious to look into the documents that they've brought out from both their collection and from the Library Company. And we have members of the staff from both the Library Company and the HSP here, and I hope they'll join with us in the discussion in the second half about manuscripts, their use, and possibly their future. The book is large, as you can see, and it consists of correspondence, manuscripts, appendices, art, and we're going to touch on each of these aspects, but our coverage will be a little bit uneven based on the participants that we have here. Some of our contributors live at a great distance. One of our contributors unfortunately died in the course of putting the book together. So they're going to be talking about the individual contributions that they made. And I'm going to introduce them now, but I hope they'll quickly introduce themselves again when we get to the point where they give a little talk about what it is that they especially worked on, their experience with the manuscript. At the end of the table, I have Bob Peck. He is a senior fellow from the Academy of Natural Sciences, and he wrote the prologue to the volume that reviewed the life of William Bartram and summarized the new perspectives that emerged from our research. Next, I have William Cahill. William Cahill is an independent scholar. He formerly was a teacher at Rutgers University. We have Joel Fry, who is a curator at Bartram's Garden. He was an associate editor and put together a very comprehensive plant index that is a wonderful complement to the book. On my left, I have Thomas Halleck, who is a principal co-editor from the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg, where he's an associate professor of English. And on the end, Catherine Braun, who is the Hallifield professor of Southern History at Auburn University in Alabama. So I think that completes our quick introductions, and then they can just tell you who they are when we come back. Five of us as contributors transcribed manuscripts and wrote essays of introduction to the manuscripts. In the first portion of our program, each of the contributors will share highlights of their work, and then there'll be time for questions and comments. And as a second portion of the program today, we'd like to consider the rather special question of the value of transcribing and printing manuscripts in the age of digitized scans. As panelists, we've been thinking about examples where the use of the actual manuscript altered or impacted our transcription or interpretation of the manuscript's content. I hope those of you in the audience who have worked with manuscripts will be thinking of examples from your own experience and thinking about the current shift in the way manuscripts are used and preserved, and we'll feel very free to enter our discussion. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you will be able to ask us about and contribute from your own experience. So I'll start with Bob again.
Thank you, Nancy. Good afternoon, everyone. It's a thrill for me to be here for the official launch, although I think there's also been one in Florida, of this wonderful new book, because I see this as a sort of coming of age for William Bartram and the beginning of a whole new era in Bartram scholarship. In 1977, I was invited to head up a congressionally funded study of a Bartram trail, or a proposed Bartram trail through the Deep South, some 2,400 miles, eight states. I was given a leave of absence from the Academy of Natural Sciences and went down to the Bartram Trail Conference headquarters in Montgomery, Alabama. It was a fascinating year. I had a chance to travel, not all 2,400 miles, but a good part of it, and meet with Bartram experts and enthusiasts all along the way. My role was to try to put together a proposal that each of the states would want to fund or get behind and hopefully get some federal money as well, which meant not just saying where Bartram had gone, but sort of what was the significance of his travels and the book that he published based on those travels. At the time, there was relatively little scholarship on William Bartram. John Bartram was the much better known of the Bartram family. The John Bartram Association had been promoting his memory, and William was seen as sort of the slightly eccentric son, a little bit of a loner. He traveled in the South. He'd seen the world in a different way than most of his contemporaries. He appreciated nature aesthetically. He saw environmental relationships that others had not particularly focused on. And he sort of shied away from the more commercial aspects of wild nature, which is what most of 18th century America was focused on. Francis Harper had done a fantastic annotated naturalist edition of Bartram's travels, where he had tried to retrace much of the route, and that was a very important seminal text, really, for me in my efforts. There had been a children's book called Billy Bartram's Green World, which some of you may remember from the 1960s, which tried to sort of bring Billy Bartram to life and perhaps help to promote this rather eccentric reputation that he had. There had been a PhD dissertation on his influence on the great Romantic poets that had been published by Johns Hopkins University Press, and one or two other things, including some popular books where there'd be a chapter devoted to Bartram. But all of them presented him as a sort of one, or at best two-dimensional figure, a sort of cliche or a stereotype of the eccentric naturalist, without much interest in contemporary politics or other things that were going on in America at the time. We had visions of him sort of hanging out at Bartram's garden and enjoying himself there, but staying pretty much apart from the rest of society. What this book has done, which is so important, is to bring to light a lot of the correspondence, a lot of his manuscript material, which has been scattered in many places. Those of us who were lucky enough to be in Philadelphia, associated with one of the great institutions here, whether it was the Historical Society, the Library Company, Bartram's Garden, the Academy of Natural Sciences, American Philosophical Society, we knew that there was material here, and we fortunately had access to it. But for most of the rest of the world, all of this material was inaccessible or very expensive to access. And so as a result, Bartram scholarship kind of petered along at a very modest pace. People were interested in him, but because the original materials weren't available, some of them even in England, particularly some of the illustrations which are reproduced here for the first time, very few people appreciated the breadth of Bartram's involvement in science and in politics and in so many other issues of his day. The depth of his intellect, the really very social nature of his personality. It's easy to dismiss him as a recluse, but actually when you read his letters here, you see that he was quite sociable and engaged with so many of his important contemporaries. So my hat is off to Tom and Nancy and all of those who worked on this important book, because I think this really has put Bartram in a totally new light. And I suspect that scholars now and for generations to come will be referring to this as the new Bartram Bible. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you. A Bible is a little scary. My name is Thomas Halleck. I am one of my hats. I'm associate professor of English. One of my hats also is president of the William Bartram Trail Conference, or as I like to call it jokingly, the Bartram Chamber of Commerce. I am happy to support all things Bartramia. Please see me if you would like a flyer, a newsletter. I also want to thank Nancy, who's put a lot of work into this particular event. I don't even have to thank for the book. We've been over that. HSP, the library company, and the McLean receivership, who allowed me to come here. I don't know. I wish I remembered when. Several years ago, and conduct my research in this, a lot of the room in the next door at the library company, at the American Philosophical Society, and at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. It's a real pleasure to be here for a number of reasons, and I don't quite know how to put this except just to celebrate the fact that the book exists. One of the real challenges of this volume was negotiating between the several needs for and possible uses of such a book. Particularly where I live in Florida, in Georgia, in Alabama, there's a tremendous popular interest in William Bartram, and we would have been remiss if we did not take general readers into account. Yet we also wanted to provide a scholarly volume, a volume that would serve as a lasting and definitive record. We also had to negotiate between several disciplinary demands with scholars, with people trained in botany, with archaeology, historians, art historians, religious historians, literary critics. And each of us have a different way or expectations for how a document should be presented. And so I'm very happy that the University of Georgia Press really was extraordinarily generous. The Watson Brown Foundation gave us some support. And we were able to really present a book in such a way without having to make too many compromises. My task is specifically to talk about the letters. That was the part that I really worked the most on. And that's a classic example of there being much more than most people ever realized. There are actually over 200 letters to, from, and primarily about William Bartram. It's kind of like Emily Dickinson poems. We can actually argue all day what constitutes a Bartram letter. There's also over 200 surviving illustrations. As Joel Fry has pointed out, stuff is going to keep trickling in over the next few years, especially as material comes digitized. I'm certain of it. I've just in the volume has a calendar of correspondence and an index of illustrations and. These in some ways are back in the day we had the blank holes in the periodic table. I think they will be filled in. What I want to say about the letters kind of comes down to this one document. This is from Benjamin Smith Barton on one side to William Bartram. Benjamin Smith Barton, of course, was the professor of Materia Medica at University of Pennsylvania now. And this is one of dozens of requests for William for information. He was kind of the information source pump for William. And this actually covers a book I send along. I send along with this for your perusal, a new work of considerable merit. I think the chapter on instinct will please you. It's not entirely clear what the book that he's sending along is. It could be that there is a chapter on instinct by William Smellie, which is back there. And he says, by the way, don't forget about the wasps. In that volume back there, in William Smellie's book, is actually a fly in the binding of where there's a discussion of one. On the back of the document, however, there are also discussions from Natural History of Selborne, Gilbert White, Naturalist Calendar, And then if you flip it upside down, there's actually a long draft essay of Bartram's Atlantic Plain. And it becomes pretty clear that I think Bartram, those that specialize in botany and natural history can correct me and elaborate more, but that Bartram really saw the Atlantic coast and the Atlantic plain as one sort of biological unit. He was very interested in plant distribution for obvious reasons. He's from a family of horticulturalists. Right, so he's really thinking about plant soil types, plant zones, I guess we would say now. And the reason why I really love this letter, and the reason why I think it's kind of a singular document, a good representative document, is it illustrates how the letters capture, how these documents capture a mind in motion. And the way Bartram would get a book from a friend, okay? And on the back he would take some notes on the reading, and then he would combine that with observation made in the field. And I think that's a certain sense. I think these correspondents capture this workshop into his thinking. That's what we were really looking at with the correspondence, with the art, is these networks of knowledge, not only the human networks, but the interconnectedness between reading, observation, friendship, reflection, illustration, science, and the ways in which these all come together in the letters. Towards the back there, there's a drawing of Bartram's fringilla, or a fringe tree. And that was sent to his patron, Peter Collinson, his father's patron, really, Peter Collinson. And Collinson praises the delightful natural freedom of the insects crawling up the side of the leaf. I believe it's a caterpillar. That occurs a lot in the correspondence. I don't think anyone has made these connections before, because the documents and the drawings are in different places. But drawings in London, in the collection of John Fothergill, have commentary here in Philadelphia. So John Fothergill would say, well, these are great drawings, but why are they in black and white? Or these are great drawings, but could you enlarge the parts of fructification, the anatomical parts? And Bartram, in his next series of letters, would. I think it's really important to look at these documents in relationship, in concert with one another. And that's, I think, what I'm hoping is one of the achievements of the book, is that people will be looking at a much broader and complicated and diverse William Bartram. Thank you.
So I'm next. I'm Joel Fry. I'm the curator of Bartram's Garden. And my background is really archaeology to begin with, so I've become a kind of strange archaeologist because I deal with documents a lot and botany even as well. But Nancy and I both were in American Civilization at Penn, which is a late lamented program, you know, which we could get into why did that fail or where did it go, but I won't even talk about that now. For this book, I did a lot of different things. I wrote first on William Bartram's Commonplace book, which is a book, a large manuscript by William Bartram that remains in private hands. It's in the hands of a Bartram family member. I worked on the plant index, I worked on the catalog of Bartram's art, the chronology of his travels. I added some Philadelphia-centric footnotes for things, you know, there's a lot of annotation to these letters. And I also wound up editing Renata Wilson's piece on the pharmacopoeia. Renata Wilson was a very, very talented medical historian from Johns Hopkins, who one of the last things she worked on was this pharmacopoeia, which has been sitting in the catalog here at the HSB for over 100 years, and no one's known what to think of it. They've looked at it kind of and described it in print in many different ways, saying it's a set of plant medicines or whatever, but it's really a very high-level medical set of recipes for pharmaceutical medicine. And one thing that to me is very interesting in this book is it what has come out in it is how much medical knowledge William Bartram had. He had as much medical knowledge as any trained doctor in Philadelphia. And that's, something that in the future something can be researched at a much higher level. Well, the Commonplace book, as I say, it's a manuscript volume retained by the Bartram family, and I think Bob Peck had borrowed it maybe 20 years ago, and it got microfilmed by the APS, but it's virtually unreadable in the microfilm. And for years, I read through it in a photocopy off the microfilm, which was even harder to read. Puzzling is, what is this talking about? How, what word is this? Finally, I decided, in fact, I tried to transcribe the essay I worked with, which is the very opening. The opening part of the Commonplace book is an essay called On Gardening, which is a 16-page essay by William Bartram. Nancy and I thought about working on a book, and I was going to transcribe this essay. So I tried from the photocopy, just couldn't really do it. So eventually, Bill Cahill and I went and borrowed it from the woman who owns it, and over a summer in, 4 or 5 years ago, I scanned it myself and now can read it and, found that this is a very important document. And it's really not a commonplace book in the sense that people know commonplace books. It's a set of small little notebooks. They're very small size, what's called septo-decimo, which is a sheet folded into 16 leaves or 32 pages, ideally, except when you start counting through the book, the little folded signatures aren't all 16 pages or 32 pages. They're 10 pages and 25 pages and as many as 50. So it's a funny set of little notebooks that probably once were totally separate, probably had their own covers. And what helps to prove that fact is there's one of these notebooks here in the HSP, exactly the same format and dated. It's dated from 1797 to 1803, and that volume is back here on display. It has a little marbleized paper cover. So these little notebooks, William Bartram could have made them up himself. He could have taken a sheet and folded it and cut it and sewn it. But I think more likely you could probably buy these in Philadelphia at a stationer shop. They probably were little scratch notebooks. And they're all different. So it's very clear they never were intended to be bound into a book. And some of them are what you would call a commonplace book. A commonplace book is an interesting topic, and that itself, we could talk a long, long time about it, but commonplace books are interesting cultural phenomena, and they come out of the classical world where they weren't books, where they were something you memorized. In classical rhetoric, you in Greece and Rome, you memorized these things called topos or topoi, which are places. That word means place in Greek. And Lane Cooper, who's an important Bartram scholar, kind of rediscovered William Bartram's travels in the early 20th century, wrote about commonplace books. He calls them something like pigeonholes in the mind. Someone else, Kenneth Lockridge, calls them the visible reproduction of linguistic memory. So they're really important cultural documents. They're assemblages of all the knowledge and intellectual thought. And again, me as an archaeologist finds this interesting because archaeologists deal with assemblages. Artifacts, usually stuff, broken little stuff. But this commonplace book is a bunch of little fragments of William Bartram's mind that someone can put together. Now, for this book, I couldn't do an analysis of the entire commonplace book. It's just too massive. And even figuring out the source of all these quotes is something yet to be done. So that's a work someone could do. Someone could write a dissertation on the whole commonplace book or publish the whole thing and figure out all the transcriptions. And one interesting thing is it's now easy to find the sources. When I first started looking at them, I'm like, well, who said this in the 18th century? Who wrote this poem? Who wrote this lugubrious poem that I don't know anything about? You can now type fragments of that poem into Google and up comes the published source it comes from. So, it's something to be done. Well, so as I say, I worked on just the first essay. It's really the first signature or codex out of the commonplace book. But the whole book includes natural history notes. It includes Linnaean plant names and descriptions, sometimes in Latin. Natural history notes on insects, flora, and fauna. Horticultural notes and techniques. There's a lot on vine dressing, on vineyards in France and Italy, on bees, recipes for food, how to preserve cucumbers and various things, how to make preserves out of oranges, medicines. There's a whole set, probably one or two of the little notebooks are medicinal recipes, things for how to cure yellow fever and tetanus and various other things. There's poetry, a lot of quotes, particularly from William Shenstone, which is important. It's very clear William Shenstone was an important influence on William Bartram and his writing. And the circle of English pastoral poets around William Shenstone. There's classical history, there's literature, lots on early American explorations. William Bartram seemed fascinated with Columbus and Magellan and all the Spanish explorers, and Captain Cook's explorations. So anyway, that's what's in the whole book. What I wrote about is On Gardening, which is a little essay, and it's thoughts on the design of an ideal garden. Taken from Philip Miller, virtually you could say plagiarized from Philip Miller, but it's really William Bartram reading through several entries in Philip Miller's Gardener's Dictionary and combining them down into a simple essay. So it's tightly edited, reorganized from what Miller wrote. So it's an interesting little example of writing where William Bartram is taking from multiple sources in Philip Miller and writing it down into a garden. That one section is interesting. It can be dated because in the midst of it, there's several short poems. Sections quoted from Shenstone and from an essay by William Shenstone on religion. William Shenstone's an important writer and a gardener in England. He really invented the Fair Mornay and is very well known in England as a landscape designer. So it's interesting that William Bartram's quoting Shenstone for that reason. Shenstone's complete works appear in two volumes in 1764, so that helps date this little manuscript. William Bartram couldn't have written it before 1764 when those various things were available. And I think more likely the On Gardening was written between 68 and 1770. So anyway, this essay is a valuable discussion of garden design and philosophy by someone in the Bartram family. It's helping us at Bartram's garden to restore the garden, because John Bartram very rarely wrote about his garden. He wrote reams about plants and, you know, how he's growing plants he's sending to England, but he very rarely says how he's laying out his garden or what they're like. So here, William Bartram has a whole essay on what's an ideal garden, and interestingly, what he's describing parallels the site of Bartram's garden. It's a garden facing to the southeast, with little hills on either side. The house is on a terrace with parterres in front of it, above, you know, terraces that drop down to a water feature. There are views and vistas and all that. So this is a very important document for us at Bartram's Garden as we move forward to restore the garden.
Well, one of the pieces that I worked on for this volume was the draft manuscript for Travels. And it's actually at the HSP in three small volumes. And those three volumes correspond to the central portion of the book Travels, the really exciting portion of the book Travels, where Bartram travels up the St. John's River, which he did several times, but he collapses it into one voyage. The content, as I said, corresponds to this. And I actually read this draft before I ever read Travels, so I'll come back to that again. I want to start by saying that in the middle of the 19th century, when Bartram's Travels was a largely forgotten book, Thomas Carlyle recommended it to Emerson, saying it had a wonderful kind of floundering eloquence in it. It was, in fact, he said, something old, almost biblical. Well, I think Carlyle's astute as characterization of the book Bartram wrote in 1791. As a literary production, it floats between genres, a mix of travel narrative, natural history description, and philosophic reflection. Its prose style is often rapturous, but sometimes scientific and without metaphors, and it alternates between these styles. Now, drafts for books, such as the draft for James Joyce's Ulysses, that is such a valued part of the Rosenbach Library, have been highly regarded by scholars because they believe to express an author's first intentions for his work. I have been looking for such a manuscript, not specifically a literary one, but one probably about travel or science. I had seen the draft manuscript listed in a bibliography from that 1933 book that you referred to earlier about Bartram, and I knew that it had been referenced occasionally, but only slightly, so it wasn't a well-known draft. It was here at the HSP, and when I called for it, the librarian, who was Linda Stanley at the time, brought it out. "You're going to like this," she said, and she was right. From the first pages, I love the rhythm of the sentences, the push of the narrative, as Bartram describes successive scenes on his journey up the St. John's River in Florida. And here I'd like to read just a brief passage that records those experiences watching alligators as they enjoyed the annual feast or frolic of fish surging up the St. John's. He writes, "Perhaps I should be doubted, but I speak only the truth. But then how shall I make a choice of words or expression to inform your understanding of those shocking, tumultuous scenes that for some minutes continues in view whilst this mighty army of fish are forcing the pass? In a few minutes, thousands, may I say hundreds of barrels of them are caught, chopped to pieces and swallowed by those monsters. I have seen one alligator continue in one spot, take up deliberately out of the water several great fish at a time and squeeze them twixt his jaws, the tails of the great trout slapping his lips and eyes in their struggles. The horrid noise of the clapping jaws, they're rising with them in the fearful jaws, some feet upright above the water, the floods of water, blood and slime rushing out of their mouths and nostrils." So I hope that gives you a little taste of the draft. and why I was so intrigued with it. So, at this point, I turned to the printed text of Travels for corresponding passages. I didn't find the prose quite as dramatic or exciting. It was fairly similar in the choice of actual events, but instead the same scenes had become more static, more distant in voice. I also noticed from my first readings of the manuscript there are numerous corrections, additions of words, changes in verb, tense, written throughout, and a different ink and penmanship. Thus, I began my process of analyzing just what had happened to the original draft as it became the printed text, and a frustrating search for any editor or intermediate text that would have served as a copy text for printing, and also more biographical details about the printer of Travels and the subscribers to that first edition. But although the draft manuscript of Travels doesn't answer any of these questions, it does serve as a wonderful example of how an author's intentions for a particular book are expressed more clearly at an early stage. We find in this draft, for instance, a prayerful, philosophic pilgrim who takes up his daily task to wander in nature and await an inpouring of the philosophic spirit. We hear from Bartram a sincere expression about the absolute equality of animals with men, and read many passages of respect for Indian life, which he finds more harmonious with nature. What is probably most innovative about Bartram's draft, a kind of experimental text, is the way he sought to integrate natural history with narrative. As he goes along, he seeks to keep the mind, and this is a quote, awake to reflection and contemplation and the various novel scenes and natural objects that present themselves to view. So in Travels, we see Bartram stopping along the trail to admire a plant or bird, then gracefully moving ahead with his narrative. It was this incorporation of direct observation and narrative that became Bartram's permanent contribution to later nature writing, influencing Thoreau, who is a reader of Travels, as well as others. From investigating Bartram's social world, from evidence and letters, like the ones written by Enoch Story and Robert Parrish, letters that we include in this volume, we learn about their attempts to find money for publication. I tracked a faint record about the editors, James and Johnson, attempting to find answers about how changes were made to the original draft. As we know, publishers need to have marketable books, and Bartram's draft, charming as it might have been, was not a publishable text. It was too personal, a retrospective, meditative account of his journey. It might have had brilliant moments, but it lacked a consistent lens or perspective. And it lacked a way to incorporate all the natural history material that would ultimately make it such a valuable book. A young, I say 25-year-old Quaker newspaper man from Reading, Pennsylvania, named Benjamin Johnson, undertook the job of transforming a text similar to this draft into a more acceptable, more generic, rather than Quakerly, Christian book. His publication was supported through subscriptions by members of major denominations from Philadelphia churches and political figures here in Philadelphia and New York. When it was finally published in 1791, Travels was the largest original book in early America. And remarkably, despite the alterations, William Bartram seems to have gone along with the project, supplying drawings and even presenting the book himself to obtain copyright. What we have in the draft manuscript, then, is a different William Bartram. He is similar to the man we know from Travels, but more radical, more intent on pursuing a journey whose purpose is purely one of giving praise to God, deeply appreciative of the world he finds around him. As he writes in his draft as a wandering pilgrim, "Is it not in the power of every one of us to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly before God? Thus it is with the philosophic pilgrim. The hope and desire of arriving at the famed country celebrated by travelers for some new and remarkable display of the glory and power of the great author of nature." with such definite intentions, it's no surprise that his book, although altered, still expresses that dedicated purpose. And it's fortunate that we have the original draft to read, the one in which Bartram first voiced his passion for adventure and for the goddess as he worshipped him, the author of nature. I think that's...
Well, my part of the volume was to edit and study a set of letters exchanged between William Bartram and Henry Muhlenberg of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Seven of these letters were written in one growing season in 1792. There were two other later letters in 1810 in which Muhlenberg was querying Bartram about plants that he had mentioned, plant names he had given in travels. But when I first looked at these letters 10 or so years ago, it seemed to me that they gave a major clue about the character of William Bartram as a botanist and about what William Bartram was doing in the time after he wrote Travels. And I found that in comparing what Bartram said about plants he exchanged with Muhlenberg and what Muhlenberg said, that while these two men had a very cordial and mutually respectful relation, and they had an equal devotion to plants, really they were very, very different in what they were trying to do in botany. Muhlenberg was later called the American Linnaeus by another young botanist, younger than Muhlenberg, William Baldwin. Muhlenberg was the quintessential Linnaean botanist in America, keeping a herbarium, corresponding with other botanists in America and in Europe. A keen memory, a great collection of plants that he was going to use as a basis for publishing at least a partial American flora. He said his goal was to publish a Pennsylvania flora. The Linnaean botanist has to work with a herbarium, has to work with Linnaean books, but especially a Linnaean book called the Philosophia Botanica, in which the principles for describing a genus are laid out. Without getting into all the complexities of Linnaean science, I want to say William Bartram, although he knew the Linnaean texts very well, from a young age, and although he knew hundreds, probably thousands of plants from Pennsylvania and New Jersey and this region, and he knew them very well, he does not seem to have taken up this project of being a Linnaean botanist. It's clear in evidence in these letters. For example, one exchange that they have about a plant called, the common name is Blazing Star, and it wasn't very well described at the time in the literature. Bartram knows the plant very well. He says that his father collected the plant many years before. They grew it at the garden. And he gives a poetic description of it in his letter to Muhlenberg. And when they're debating what it is, Bartram just says to Muhlenberg, well, maybe you should find a name for it. Well, you know, Linnaean botany has always been somewhat competitive, and this was really not the spirit of Linnaean botany to say, it's probably a new family, he said. He didn't say genus. Probably a new family. Maybe you should describe it. So I was really puzzled and wondering, why is it that this man who has all this knowledge of plants, and he comes from a family that's widely known for their plant knowledge, and he knows all about Linnaeus, and he's very handy with the Linnaean text, why isn't he interested in doing that? Well, it seemed to me that what William Bartram developed, maybe more so after his southern journeys, was a personal knowledge of botany that gave him a sense of moral satisfaction because he was deeply interested in the aesthetic qualities of plants. Scientific satisfaction because he was interested in how plants grew, what kinds of soils they grew in. As Tom mentioned before, he was interested in the whole Atlantic plain as an ecosystem or a landscape of living organisms. So he got that sort of scientific interest out of it, and that wasn't exactly what Linnaean botany was about, at least not in the late 18th century. But he also got a certain social cachet out of this. It seems, you know, from the record we see many, many examples of people coming from Europe and other places in America to visit Bartram's garden and writing letters or diary entries about meeting William Bartram. And we can see that he was very much esteemed for his character and for his knowledge. So what does this all mean? In 1807, the Bartrams published a catalog of plants available at the garden. And many of the plants that William Bartram had exchanged with Henry Muhlenberg appear as names in that catalog. In a few cases, with a new name or with a decided-on name, whereas in the letters, the names were still up in the air. So that makes it seem that he learned some things from his exchange with Muhlenberg. But he writes in the preface to this catalog that many of the plants here have Linnaean names, but some of them don't. And he explains why they don't. Well, it makes sense. The Linnaean books were written in Europe, and they did not. Those botanists didn't have a complete collection of the plants in America. So there were many gaps, many missing spaces in the American flora in the Linnaean literature. But in some cases, William, he writes the abbreviation A-U-T-H, or the whole word author, next to a plant name. And he says in the introduction that he's supplying this name himself. Well, this is kind of an audacious thing to do. But you might wonder, well, why isn't he publishing somewhere a Linnaean description of the plant if he thinks it's new? Well, actually, in some of these examples, the plant isn't new. One is the goldenrod, Solidago sesia. That's a Linnaean name, but Bartram writes next to it, Auth, as if it's his name. So this is very puzzling, and I'm not sure yet that I completely understand this. But my idea about it goes along with what I learned from the Bartram-Muhlenberg letters, that William Bartram valued his sense of the plant, his sense of what it looked like, how it grew, its moral aspect, if you will, its appeal to sensibility, which was very much interesting to him, at least as much as science. And it seems that he must have traded on this personal knowledge of plants among the people that he knew. And here he was publishing this catalog and saying, you know, I know what these plants are. I've attached these names to the plants in my garden, so take it on my reputation. And he does say in the beginning of the book, the little catalog book, that John Bartram and Son would be happy to provide dried specimens of any of these plants for the curious, if anyone asks. So he's being maybe falsely modest in saying, well, I'm not quite sure what these things are in this plant catalog, but yet he's willing to back up what he says they are. So I have the impression that William Bartram's sense of botany was more personal, but at the same time, more complicated than what it would have been if he had decided to pursue a career as a, maybe I shouldn't use the word career, but if he had tried to pursue work as a classical Linnaean botanist. But another thing we can see from all of this is that he, as I said before, he had knowledge of hundreds and hundreds of plants from the local area, from Pennsylvania and from New Jersey. And there's lots of other evidence that he was receiving plants from people who were going out into southern New Jersey and out into different places in Pennsylvania collecting plants for the garden. And he was learning these botanically. But his sense of botany was not quite synonymous with the Linnaean idea. He and Henry Muhlenberg were very friendly. Muhlenberg visited Bartram's gardens a number of times. In Muhlenberg's notebooks in the APS, I found that he visited Bartram's at least once during the time when he and William were exchanging letters on August 30th. Now, it says in the first letter, Muhlenberg, that he alludes to having been at the garden in April, but he was there again in August. And Muhlenberg was also visiting William Hamilton's woodlands at the same time. And I won't go into it now, but there's a complex history to be written about the plants at the woodlands and the relation of William Bartram and William Hamilton, two very different characters who knew each other actually from a very young age. I don't think Hamilton lived at Woodlands when he was young.
No,
but when William Bartram went to the Academy of Philadelphia in 1753 as a 14-year-old, William Hamilton started there the same year as a 10-year-old. So they knew each other as kids. You know, there weren't that many students in the Academy that they wouldn't have known each other. And from their little notes that are left over in the archives from their exchanges, we can see that they were quite cordial and respected and liked each other very much. So there's a great deal of plant knowledge there. So then you have to ask, what kind of botanist was William Hamilton? I'm not going to answer that question now, but botany was extremely valuable and important as a social cachet for all of these people, but it didn't mean the same thing to each one of them.
You are. It's very nice to be back at the Historical Society. I came here many years ago in the late 80s, can you hear?
Now,
to work on a book on the Southeastern Indians, which is my special field of interest, and I came to study William Bartram not as a botanist but as a historical source, because his travels and other writings really are among the most important writings on the Southeastern Indians that are available. And I eventually did publish, we felt it was heresy at the time, my co-author Greg Wasselkoff, who's an archaeologist, anthropologist, and I, we almost felt it was heresy to sort of to rip the Indian writings out of travels and include other materials, but at the same time we thought, well, it must be done. And we wanted to present him not simply as literature, but as the valuable source he was. And my part in this project, besides cheerleading, was very small. There's one specific piece in here called Some Hints on the Civilization of the American Indians. And I've prepared some remarks. I'm not going to read them. But what I wanted to talk about tonight was what manuscripts don't say, and what we do in particular when there aren't manuscripts, and how Bartram got it wrong when he moved from observer to advisor. Because the little piece he wrote in the book is advice. It's very important advice. It's a policy statement for the George Washington administration on the first American Indian policy for the Southeastern Indians, which was a so-called civilization program. And what strikes me as a scholar of the Creek Indians, as well as Bartram, in such a striking fashion is that he is silent on some of the most tumultuous events in the new nation's history in the early part of the 19th century, and I'm talking about the Creek War, the Indians that he wrote so beautifully about in Travels, were involved in a terrible civil war. And about mid-September 1813, I know that William Bartram would have gotten news of what was the Pearl Harbor of the day, the so-called Fort Mims Massacre. It occurred very near where he discovered a beautiful, as he put it, the most brilliant herbaceous plant yet known to exist, a plant gilded with the richest golden yellow, the evening primrose, my favorite Bartram flower, which is growing in Bartram's garden today. Mm-hmm. And very near where he discovered that plant, a massacre occurred. It's called a massacre by the people who write history, the white people. But about 100 troops of the Mississippi Territorial Militia were defending a fortified settlement. Creek Indians, intent on seeking revenge for a wrong, and we could go on into that, but I'm not. But needless to say, they attacked the fort, and in a very bloody and brutal way, killed almost everyone, defenders, men, women, and children who'd gathered there, scalped people. One fetus was ripped from the woman's womb, and the lurid descriptions of the Indian destruction ran across the nation like wildfire. And William Bartram would have known about this. It was the excuse Americans needed to perpetrate revenge killings of their own. And within a few months, early 1814, every Creek Indian town, including everyone that William Bartram had visited, had been destroyed, had been burned to the ground. Thousands were dead, more thousands. Almost everyone in the Creek Nation was homeless. And a good number of the Tallapoosa towns, which he traveled through, would never be rebuilt, and their inhabitants in permanent exile among the Seminole. And yet, we have no hard evidence of what Bartram thought of the attack, or even if he knew about it, but of course he did. I'm sure he would have been sickened and saddened by the violence. And it makes me wonder, is that a fluke of time? Why didn't he write about it? Or if he did, why wasn't it preserved? Or perhaps it will be unearthed eventually one day. But a question that always comes to me when I think of Fort Mims and how close it is to the golden primrose that he saw is, when he heard the news, did he recognize in that disaster his role? And we usually think of Bartram as a very pacific person, one who would have nothing to do with violence or certainly with a violent civil war like this. And yet, that civil war among the Creek Indians was directly related to the American civilization policy that Bartram wholeheartedly endorsed in the piece that's in the book. Mm-hmm. And that piece is unlike most of his other writings on the American Indians. He puts aside what I like to call his erstwhile detachment, because he's anything but detached, but he dons the mantle of expert policy advisor. And in truth, there could have been no one else that the people in power could have turned to who knew the Southeastern Indians quite so well, then living and as loyal Americans. And there is nothing else that Bartram could have advised, because the alternative to civilizing in his mind and other people's mind was extermination. What are you going to do? How are you going to incorporate American Indians into the new expanding nation? We want their land. They don't want to give it up. What's the solution? Well, the solution, according to Bartram and many like-minded Quakers and other religious groups, was to civilize them, to bring the Indians into the American way of life, American culture, to send missionaries to Christianize them, to take them away from the commercial hunting agriculture economy that was their subsistence, and to train them to be farmers. These are the people who domesticated corn and beans, you know. We're going to teach them to be farmers. But more to the point, it was what one scholar has called an invitation to commit cultural genocide, to put aside everything that you hold dear, how you order your families, how you view property. And as the American government really moved forward with this policy in a very heavy-handed way and a manipulative way, it strained the Creeks to the point of breaking, and that's what that war was about. And I don't mean to blame Bartram for the flawed policy, but it does make, I think, painfully clear that even the most virtuous and well-intentioned can completely miss the mark when they become policy advisors. Bartram, in most of his writings, concentrated on the endearing qualities of the Creeks and other Indians he visited. He praised their hospitality, their industry, their willingness to live in friendship. And I have a quote here from Hintz. He says, "Their ideas with respect to the duties and conduct of individuals to their superiors coincide with those of the most perfect government on earth." But they had what he thought of, and others too, as a more true democracy than the representative government the new Americans had instituted. But what happens is, if you have a skewed understanding of the cultural values that underpin Indian government, then Creek ideas about law, government, and authority began to clash with those of the Americans. And Bartram literally hinted that the changes would, as he put, require perseverance, and they must be a work of time. But Americans demanded that the change be hard and fast. And that is what that war was about. It was really to stop a revolution in government, in policy, and propriety among the Creek Indians. And I view this document, which, by the way, isn't in his own hand. It's copied. But there's no doubt in my mind, or anyone else who knows Bartram's work, that it is the product of Bartram's mind. It is the product of very mature and thoughtful deliberations. And I like to think of it, to use a garden metaphor, as an idea. It's just like a gardener who wants to train something on a trellis to make it grow in a certain way. And I think that's the way he saw this program, that you could do it in time, and you could direct things, and you would have a good end. But of course, it didn't quite work that way. It's less scholarly and less descriptive than his other writings. But I think, you know, what's wonderful about it is that Bartram's conscience took a stand in this. And it really is a plea for humane and just treatment by the new American nation. And that, to me, is what stands out so clearly. It's a moral obligation he believes that Americans have toward other people. And I think it's the only view he might have possessed, knowing Bartram. There could have been nothing else he could have advised. And as I always tell my students, the same was true for Henry Knox and George Washington and their attitudes towards the Southeastern Indians, which were so strongly shaped by Bartram, and I think by Bartram's travels, his written work. So that it was a disaster, I don't think we can lay at Bartram's door. He called for sincerity, for perseverance, benevolence, and dignity in all things. And I'd like to think how differently things would have turned out if everyone involved would have taken his advice to heart on that angle.
Yes.